Yeah, this is gonna be fun, guys. Now, this book, of course, Song of Solomon, it's a book like no other, but it's a book that is needed in the kind of sex-crazed culture that we live in. I mean, we live in a culture where that just seems to be such a dominant focus. You look at magazine covers, and what do you see? Sex, how to have great sex and stuff like that. And that's just even like on the cover of Bass Fisherman. It's just everywhere. You see this stuff. It's just weird. But you see pornography on the rise. You see people more and more getting addicted to pornography. And so the sensitivity towards anything of a sexual nature just really becomes decreased then for people. People no longer are shocked, jaded by it. When asked to prioritize what people consider to be immoral, adults put not recycling pretty near the bottom of their list. Teens and young adults, however, consider not recycling to be more immoral than viewing pornography. They put not recycling to be more immoral than viewing pornography. This is kind of where the mindset of many of our young people is at. You know, we can go through a number of stats tonight, which will change by next week, really to show how much pornography has just wreaked havoc in our culture and how people are becoming more and more open to sexuality, promiscuity. But all we need to say is that we have a major problem on our hands. I think you would all agree with that, with the kind of culture and the days that we live in. And it's true, guys, that the enemy has perverted something that God has intended to be a good thing, a wonderful act that's to be enjoyed in marriage, right? But the church's response shouldn't be to just be silent and or prudish regarding these things. God has given us an entire book here on this very subject here. And God wants to lay out his heart towards marriage, sex, and relationships that pure intimacy is both attainable and it's a blessing. And that's God's intent. That's God's desire for us. And so he's given us an entire book that deals with that subject nature. This book, though, has been a difficult one for people throughout the centuries to grasp without getting red in the face, without blushing in the cheeks. Early church fathers thought that when Solomon writes about her two breasts, you know, and you're going to hear that word come up, so just get comfortable with it right now. Don't hide under your chairs like that. But what people thought in history, early church fathers, they thought when Solomon talks about her two breasts, well, that can't be. No way. God would never put that just in the Bible to mean just that. So perhaps it's referring to the Old and the New Testaments. That must be what it means. There's a picture behind that, right? And it's the Old and New Testaments that kind of nourish us and feed us, you know. Then they thought maybe it's speaking of Moses and Aaron. And then it just gets weirder by the minute, you know, as to how people try to explain away just the true nature of what we see in the book of Song of Solomon. Listen, when Solomon talks about breasts, he's talking about breasts, all right? That's what he's dealing with here. That's what he meant. And we're going to be talking about these things too, so we need to be comfortable with it, not get shameful or you know, kind of uneasy over these things. We need to be mature, strong, don't get embarrassed. These are things that we need to get a grip on. Not those, okay. Not those things specifically, but the Bible. You know what I'm saying here. Okay, just in case you're getting worried here. So we need to get a handle on these things so that we can listen, so that we can counter. Please stay. Don't nobody get up and go. I'm going to get through this, okay? Work with me here. That was not intentional. Come on, help me out here, people. So listen, I'm going to start. I can't. I'm hearing you guys. So what we need to do, we need to get an understanding of these things so we can counter the junk that the world is trying to feed us on these subjects, on the nature of these things. We want to counter what the world is giving us and see what God has intended for us in the area of sex, marriage, relationships, all these things. This book here undercuts the two major perversions of biblical sexuality, asceticism and lust. Asceticism views sexuality as an evil to be avoided. Lust makes it the hub of life. Song of Solomon pronounces the divine, it is good, upon sexual attraction, which leads to lifelong commitment and fidelity. That's the heart here. And don't worry, we're not going to get graphic for graphic's sake. We're not going to dwell just on sex. Just to say we're an edgy church, we're going to dwell on sex. We're going to keep it PG, maybe PG-13, but that's just the rating of just reading through the book, all right? I'm not going to try to make more of it than what it's already saying to us. That's how the book is laid out for us. So we're not going to jump over anything. We're not going to skirt around something because we're feeling too awkward to deal with it. We're going to cover what the book says, but we're going to do our best to keep it on a good, healthy level. It reminds me of the 8-year-old girl who came to her dad and asked, "Dad, what's sex?" The dad was a little shocked and surprised at this question, but thought since she's asking about it, then maybe she's old enough to hear about it. So he proceeded to fill her in on all the birds and the bees discussion, explain to the best of his ability what sex was all about, and her eyes just got wider and wider as he's speaking, and suddenly he says, "Now, honey, why did you ask that question?" She replied, "Because Mom wanted me to tell you that dinner was going to be ready in a couple secs." So, now, regarding the interpretation of this book, how we interpret the book of Song of Solomon, there's been a few different ideas. And by the way, can everybody see okay? Do you want the lights on a little bit more? Okay, can we turn the lights like just right on in the sanctuary here? All right, thank you. And so there's been a lot of different ideas as to how we interpret the book of Song of Solomon. First of all, we see that there's the allegorical interpretation. Allegorical interpretation, it's a very common approach to reading Song of Solomon. Both Jews and Christians have seen in this book just an allegory more so of kind of the story of God's love for Israel. And so they read through this, and again, they're going, there's no way this can be talking about an earthly, you know, real relationship. This has got to be kind of God's intent for the nation of Israel, God's love for the nation of Israel. And then as you move into kind of the New Testament, then of course the church began to say and allegorize that this is talking about Christ and the church, the bride of Christ. And it's really just a picture of that relationship that we have in God and in Christ. Now, all things are possible for those who allegorize. And what they come up with is usually heretical. The minute that you start to go, "Oh no, this isn't real, it's just all allegorical," well then you can come up with anything that you wanted to come up with, of course. Then, of course, we see the typological interpretation. And this would see this book detailing a real-life account with historical people, yet God's intent is to provide a deeper spiritual meaning. Song of Solomon then celebrates an actual relationship between Solomon and a maiden, but Solomon is a type of Christ, and the maiden, of course, is a type of the church. Oftentimes in this view, the historical base just becomes ignored. It kind of gets pushed aside to give way only to the spiritual sort of emphasis of it. And though we could certainly draw those kinds of conclusions through the book of Song of Solomon, that it is having a picture of Christ in the church, we see that not as the interpretation, but rather an application that we can draw for us. Lastly, we see a literal interpretation. That simply says this is a single love poem that the writer intended to deal primarily with the subject of human love and marriage. This is a real love relationship between a man and a woman. Which school of thought do you think we're going to follow as we go through the book of Song of Solomon? Number three, literal interpretation. You guys are sharp. You guys are good. You're on it tonight. Okay, that's exactly right. These are real historical situations through which God intends to teach lessons regarding the divine viewpoint in the very areas of courtship, marriage, and sex, just as other historical books of the Bible teach us, of course, divine principles in other areas. Now, like I said, we're going to draw some good application through our study regarding our relationship to Christ as the bride of Christ, the church. We're going to be looking at that, no doubt about it. But don't let it take away from the very literal meaning that we're seeing here taking place between a man and a woman in this earthly human relationship taking place. Now, the book can get very confusing as you know, we begin to go through this. It can get very confusing because it's hard to always know exactly who is speaking, all right? And it bounces back and forth between the subjects here, between who's speaking. And so it becomes very hard to get an understanding. And there's different views as to who the characters are in this story. In fact, there's the view that there's three main characters, that there's the Shulamite woman, who's the object of the love, then there's Solomon, and there's also a shepherd person. It's the Shulamite and the shepherd that are engaging in love, in a love relationship, and it's Solomon who's trying to woo the Shulamite woman to himself. And so it kind of becomes a bit of a love triangle, and Solomon's trying to woo her away. The Shulamite, though, remains true to her shepherd and echoes Solomon's words of love, but directs them to the shepherd. And when Solomon sees that he won't win her love, he allows her to return home so that she can be with her shepherd lover. This view is often held by liberal theologians who already begin with a low view of the Bible. Now, there are many people that I respect that hold that view of kind of a three-person dynamic in the story. But there's also simply the two-character view that sees Solomon and the Shulamite woman as the primary characters who are in love with one another, of course. And that view is more consistent with kind of a higher view of Scripture and its inspiration. It's the view that we're going to take as we go through the book of Song of Solomon. If you studied before and you have a different view, that's all right, because like I say, there's many people I respect that give way to a three main character view, and there's many that I like that hold the two character view. As I read through it, I see that's what I'm getting out of it here, so that's the direction we're going to take as we go through it. And it's interesting, in the Hebrew language, as I said, it's hard to always know who's speaking, but in the original Hebrew language, the way that they specify the genders and the words and the amount of people that are speaking or being spoken to is easier to see in the Hebrew language. In our English language, it's a lot more difficult. But if you got the New King James Version, as I'm reading through, you'll see a lot of the headings that they do their best to put in there as a heading, who is speaking. How many people have headings as to who's speaking in each of those sections? Okay, a few of you. So I'll do my best to kind of lay it out for you to let you know who is speaking and who's directing that. But again, those are added. Of course, that's not part of the inspiration of Scripture. Those are added to make it helpful to us. And for the most part, they get it pretty right, I'd say. But there's room to kind of adjust that a little bit as well. But it'll help us out here. But in that two-character view, what we see happening here is Solomon, whenever there's a mention of the shepherd, it's speaking of Solomon, who oftentimes kings in Israel were referred to as shepherds. They were shepherding the nation, you see. And oftentimes they had vast amounts of livestock themselves, so they oftentimes took on that kind of role themselves. So what we see in the story is that Solomon owns a vineyard in Lower Galilee, in the town near Shunem, which is where the Shulamite comes from. And he's visiting there one day. He catches the eye of this farm girl as she's taking care of her family's vineyard. Solomon falls in love with her, being in courtship with her, making multiple visits to her country home. She agrees to marry him, and he soon sends a wedding procession to bring the bride to his palace in Jerusalem. Soon after the wedding ceremony takes place, followed by the wedding banquet and the wedding night, all of which, of course, is described for us in detail in the book, right down to the honeymoon. So you'll get all of that in the book here. And because we go through verse by verse, we're not going to skip over any of that, like I said. Okay, so after some struggles in this newfound intimacy, though, what we see is that the bride longs to visit her home, of which Solomon agrees to go back with her. They make a visit to her home with him, just coming and renewing that love covenant. And then the book closes with the enjoyment of this pure intimacy back in this mountain home of the Shulamite. So that's kind of a summary of the book. And this, what I just shared, is the historical background and the chronological flow of the book. However, as we go through the book, it doesn't follow a complete chronological flow, all right? Since the song is in the form of a lyric, idyll, a narrative poem, often of a romantic theme, well, all these elements of the story that I shared will be found in the song. They're not always related in this particular chronological sequence. So the historical sequence is, as noted, as I said, can only be deducted as we look at sort of the breakdown of those five lyrical poems and idols. And so here's what we see in our outline as we go through the book of Song of Solomon. We'll see reflections on the wedding day. So the Shulamite primarily be reflecting back on that wedding day, right at the very beginning, all right? She'll recount some of the parts of the courtship. Then we'll go back and look at the courtship in chapter 2 into chapter 3. We'll look at the reflections on the marital union, then on marital adjustments, and then final reflections give way to that journey back home. So that's kind of the breakdown that we see, and we'll kind of follow that as we go along in our study here. And though Solomon is the author of this book, many of these reflections are going to be given through the Shulamite woman, the bride here in this story. The primary exchanges take place between the two main characters, the Shulamite and Solomon. And there's the occasional interjection by this group called the Daughters of Jerusalem. Many believe it's an actual harem of Solomon that the Shulamite was brought into, built relationships with them. Some believe it's perhaps just friends of the Shulamite women, kind of like bridesmaids would be. But there's going to be exchange given towards them. And we're going to hear from these Daughters of Jerusalem as well, speaking and sharing their heart in these matters. So two primary characters with a little bit of interjection from other people being spoken, but the bulk of the interjections or the reflections are being given by the Shulamite woman. So let's get into this here. Verse 1, it says, the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. The book just begins right here saying that it's a song of all songs. Remember that Solomon wrote 1,005 songs. It says in 1 Kings 4:32, he spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. So Solomon wrote not only a lot of proverbs, but he wrote a lot of songs. And what Solomon is saying is, this song right here is the one that kind of rises to the top. This is like not just the greatest hits. I mean, this is primarily the number one song right here. This is the best of them all, the Song of Songs. That's what he's referring it as. And then we read in verse 2, and here now is the Shulamite woman speaking forth. She says, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine. Because of the fragrance of your good ointments, your name is ointment poured forth. Therefore, the virgins love you. And so, again, she's reflecting back on that marriage day. They've already met here, okay? We'll go back and look at that courtship, but they've already met. She's reflecting on this wedding day, and her desire is just to be with him. This perhaps maybe looking ahead to the very wedding night now. The courtship has been going on. She's in the king's chambers. Perhaps the wedding is even taking place, and she's just waiting that wedding night consummation now. And she's just longing for him. Kiss me with the kisses of his mouth here. And what we see here is that intimacy is a two-way street. All right? I like that. She's not initiating intimacy or physical contact, but she's desiring it. She's kind of giving the green light in a sense. Sometimes we think that, you know, we feel the guy must always initiate things. That's just the way it's to be. But ladies, it's okay. You can show a desire for intimacy, all right? And you can show a desire for physicality, and you can even initiate it. Because this is a God-given desire that all of us are to have. And these kisses would be then kind of that foreplay leading up to that act of sex. Men, take some cues on that one. Okay. She says, your love is better than wine. Wine in the Bible is often representative of joy. Wine, joy. Jesus turned water into wine at that wedding as his first public miracle that he did. And it was better than what preceded it. That wine that Jesus gave just caused great celebration. It's better than anything that came before it. And for us, we understand that Jesus is always better than any earthly substance we could ever have. His love will always fill us with that joy and satisfaction. And here's the Shulamite saying, your love is better than wine. And we can understand that, no doubt, regarding Jesus. His love is better than anything that we could ever, you know, sink our teeth into or grab a hold of that this world might throw at us. Your name is ointment poured forth, she said. Solomon's name, in other words, his character, was as sweet and pleasant as perfume or ointment. He conducted himself in a way where he was just admired, and the Shulamite can see why the virgins swooned over him. Therefore, she says at the end of verse 3, the virgins love you. Remember what it was like when you first started getting all goo-goo over someone that caught your attention? Maybe it's with your spouse. Maybe it's if you're single, a former girlfriend or boyfriend. But you just had to hear their name, you know? Just their name being spoken, you get all giddy. You just get all excited. You're just like, oh man, it's precious. Here, she's saying, your name is ointment poured forth. It's just refreshing. It's just, you know, doing something. And so with these thoughts in mind, the Shulamite is asking him to draw her away now. Come and take me now is kind of what she's crying out. She says in verse 4, draw me away and we will run after you. The king has brought me into his chambers. We will be glad and rejoice in you. We will remember your love more than wine. Rightly do they love you. So her desire is to be with him. Just draw me away. You know, let's just be together. We can be drawn away by many things in this world, but do you carve away time with your spouse? Are you taking time to just get away with your loved one? Do you make the time to be drawn away together? Even if it's just to talk together. It doesn't always have to be sans clothes. It doesn't always have to be leading up to something. It's just time to be away where you can talk and you can just be together and share with one another. Now, in this one verse, verse 4, we have this exchange going on, going from the Shulamite to the daughters of Jerusalem, to the Shulamite, back to the daughters of Jerusalem, and then to the Shulamite again. So the daughters of Jerusalem, they're agreeing, possibly speaking of Solomon's harem again, this daughters of Jerusalem, they're agreeing with what the Shulamite is saying. They express their desire to see how this relationship unfolds. And so what do they say? "We will run after you," they say. "We want to follow after you. We're just excited for you. We want to see how this relationship is going to unfold." They admire Solomon. They've been supportive of the Shulamite. And they seem generally interested in the relationship just being successful. For those looking for that special someone, understand what great value your friends can be. Because they can speak insightfully into your situation. And they can see things that sometimes we get blinded to because of our own emotions, because we're just so enraptured with, you know, feelings of love and this emotion is going that we don't always think straight. And you've probably encountered at times where you've seen a friend get involved with something. You go, "This isn't good. This is not a good relationship. You know, this is not good. You need to get out of that." And you hear your friend going, "What are you talking about? No, he just loves me so much and I love him. And oh, it's just so great. And love will conquer all." And they just go, blah, blah, you know. And it's like, "No, listen. This is not a good, he is not good for you. This is not a good relationship." And we need to be careful that we are listening to friends. Listen, they don't have the final say, but you need to be open to what they're saying and consider it and understand that they're able to see things and perceive things that we oftentimes are missing because of us being in that relationship. So here we see these daughters of Jerusalem that have become friends with the Shulamite, and they're just excited. They're going after, they're saying, "Man, we are excited about this. We will be glad and rejoice in you," is what they say later on in verse 4. They're excited for it. And the Shulamite's response is to see that they love Solomon very much. They have such respect for him that they're not jealous or they're not catty over this woman, Shulamite, winning him over. You know, there's no slumber party massacre going on here. They're all just sort of getting along and supportive and excited for this love relationship that's forming. Rightly, the Shulamite says, "Rightly do they love you." Speaking of Solomon, looking at these daughters of Jerusalem and seeing just the love they have, and rightly do they love you. But then the Shulamite here now in verse 5 starts to show a little bit of insecurity now, okay? And no doubt, we've all been there at times. We've seen things in a relationship where we start to go, you know, "Is he really going to stay committed to me? Does he really love me? Or is she really interested in me?" Well, here's some insecurities forming. And she says in verse 5, "I am dark but lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon. Do not look upon me because I am dark, because the sun has tanned me. My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me the keeper of the vineyards, but my own vineyard I have not kept." So as the Shulamite came into this harem, she really stood out from the others. She was tanned. She had this dark complexion. Everyone else was of this white complexion. Now, for us, having a tan can be a good thing. There's a great market out there for just going to a tanning salon. You go lay in a tanning bed, you get all dark, and it's like, "Wow, cool, look at you, you're all dark. How'd you get so dark?" You know. And in this culture, it's kind of a good thing. But back in this day, you know, to have white skin, fair skin, you know, was something that was to be kind of praised. It sort of meant that you're not relegated to being outside working in the fields or doing this, but you've maybe got a kind of a high life in a sense. So this woman, the Shulamite, is going, "I'm dark, you know, I'm like the tents of Kedar," meaning that, you know, the tents of Kedar were like these nomadic tribes, descendants of Ishmael, and they would have these goat hair tents that were very dark, of course. And so she's comparing her skin to that. But the reason for her dark skin was from working out in the family's vineyard. She was a hard worker. And she's out kind of in the outdoors, out kind of in the, you know, lower Galilee region. She's kind of like a hillbilly in a sense, all right? That's kind of, she's sort of beautiful, but she's very backwoods, right? But Solomon loved her anyways. Solomon had a palace of supermodels, you could say, you know? He's got his girls there, but this Shulamite had a natural beauty. She wasn't trying to fix herself up with store-bought beauty. She was simply a woman of virtue. And she won over the king. And that's the way it should be. True love isn't based on an outward beauty. That's because that becomes just very fleeting. Outward beauty is constantly changing. Love for one another needs to be a settled, committed love for who the person is, not what they look like. If you're basing your affection, your relationship, based on how a person looks, that's very shallow. What are you going to do when suddenly that changes? And love really is then simply a decision we make. It's a decision we make. It's a commitment to that love. Feelings and emotions of intimacy and attraction grow and intensify as we commit ourselves to a single person. As we decide, as we commit ourselves to loving that person, being devoted to them, guess what's going to happen? Feelings and emotions are going to come from that. And that love is going to intensify and grow. So, she's kind of looking down on herself. She's struggling through these things. But Solomon, no doubt, was there to show that kind of love. And we'll see that as we move along here in our story. So, she's out working family's vineyard. Her brothers kind of made her do it, she said. We're not sure why exactly. But in so doing, she's kind of let herself go. She says there, "They've made me the keeper of the vineyards," the end of verse 6. "But my own vineyard I've not kept." And she's referring to herself. She's like, I'm kind of unkempt here. My hair is a mess. I'm a little bit dirty here. I've not taken care of myself. And Solomon's just like, it's okay. You know, I love you anyways. And I love that. You know, again, just men especially, be careful that you're not placing emphasis upon physical beauty. You know, love your wife. Wives, love your husbands. And the more that you commit to loving each other, the more you're going to grow in just that feeling of love and the attraction and emotion and that intimacy just grows even from that. Verse 7 says, "Tell me, O you whom I love, where you feed your flock, where you make it rest at noon. For why should I be as one who veils herself by the flocks of your companions?" So it's believed that the Shulamite is looking back on the early days here of her and her Solomon meeting. She's reflecting on the marriage day, but even in that marriage day, they're kind of reflecting back on what once was, you know, what took place before. When glances were exchanged and flirting was in full swing, some believe that Solomon had come sort of incognito and was walking among the vineyards when the Shulamite and he began eyeing one another. The Shulamite is desiring to be with him. She wonders where he'll be, where he'd be bringing the flocks to rest at noon, which was the time of day. You would naturally go and take a break. It's in the full heat of the day. You go and find some shade. You take a little siesta. You take a little break. And so she's wondering, where are you resting at noon? Because let's meet up together. And notice her concern. Why should I be as one who veils herself by the flocks of your companions? She's concerned over not being a person that seems of loose morals, you know. She doesn't want to be wandering around with a veil. That was often the way a prostitute would make herself known. She doesn't want to simply be like one of the other ladies in the harem. And she says there, I don't want to be like the flocks of your companions. She wants to be for Solomon and him alone. And she doesn't want to give any wrong impressions about who she is. So, here we see the Shulamite girl was both humble and she was also a woman of integrity. She didn't want to, you know, make an ostentatious search for Solomon. She didn't want to give people reason to think that she was playing the field. She goes, just let me know where you're going to be. Let me just go directly to you. Let me not hang out with the rest of the women. Be like one of the flocks of your companions. She shows us that what others think does matter. We need to be careful when we get into these relationships, or if you're someone's looking for a relationship, that we don't attempt to be more provocative in an attempt to attract attention. Be godly. Be holy. Be a person of integrity and humility. If you're attracting someone by being provocative or a person of loose morals, then that's not the person for you. You can be sure of that. Be a person who's a God person, a person that's holy and integral. And that's going to be the person for you that is attracted to that. Verse 8 says, if you do not know, O fairest among women, follow in the footsteps of the flock and feed your little goats beside the shepherd's tents. I've compared you, my love, to my filly among Pharaoh's chariots. So here's Solomon speaking back now in response. Solomon gladly welcomes her presence, her companionship. He gives direction on how to be together, where to find him. I mean, he's not making excuses to avoid her, right? Being with a spouse or being with a boyfriend or girlfriend should never be a chore. You know, it should never be something that we're going, oh man, spouse wants to go out tonight. That should never be a chore. You know, the term, the old ball and chain should never come out of our mouths. That's a stupid saying. The old ball and chain. We should always be looking, like I said earlier, to have that time where we're inviting one another in to just have togetherness, to have times where we're just simply together. And now Solomon does something that may not always go over smoothly in our day and age. He basically says to the Shulamite woman, you're like one of Pharaoh's horses. Man, don't try that line on your wives. That's probably not going to work out too well today. But a filly was a female horse, upwards of about 3 years old. The chariots would have been primarily pulled by male horses, by stallions, right? So what Solomon is saying here is that she stands out. She's like a filly among the stallions. She's like the only woman among a sea of men. And he's like in hot pursuit of her. This is what he's implying by that. You're my filly among Pharaoh's chariots. You stand out. You're different than everyone else. I mean, could you imagine, ladies, if you were the last female on earth, right? I mean, your phone would be ringing off the hook, right? Everybody would be in hot pursuit, all the guys. And that's kind of what Solomon's saying. He's like, you're the only one that I got eyes for. You're the only one that I'm seeing here. You're like a filly among all the stallions out there. Basically, Solomon's saying that he only has eyes for her. And that would have meant so much for this woman who has already shown some of that insecurity that she's had, right? Insecurity about her complexion, her skin color, her laborious life. That's important, guys, that we make one another feel safe. That we make one another feel loved. We all struggle with insecurities and different things, and we should be building one another up, not adding to the insecurities, especially when it comes to those relationships regarding marriage and intimate relationships. We need to build one another up. We need to show people how just loving and lovable they are. Reminds me of the story of a long time ago on the island of Oahu in the Hawaiian Islands. An unusual custom was observed. For a daughter's hand in marriage, cows were paid by a prospective husband to her family. The regular rate was 3 cows for a wife. If the girl was very special, 4 cows would be given. And there was an unconfirmed story that a young lady a very long time ago had gone for the amazing sum of 5 cows. Now, the story goes that there was one father who had 2 daughters. The younger one was very pretty. The older one was what our society would call a bit of a outcast or loser. Her father had determined that he only expected to receive 2 cows for the eldest daughter. And if the suitor was a good bargainer, he was willing to even let her go for just 1 cow. The truth is, old dad was willing to rid himself of the burden of having to feed her all of her life, or no cows at all even. So when Johnny Lingo, the richest man on the island, came to his home, there was no doubt that he'd come to see the younger daughter. Everyone was stunned when he called out for the older daughter. Old dad was overjoyed. Since Johnny was a wealthy man and known to be generous, old dad expected him to pay at least the standard sum of 3 cows, or maybe even 4 cows. You can imagine his utter shock when Johnny came to claim his bride and brought 10 cows with him. Old dad almost had a heart attack. He quickly called the tribal chief to perform the ceremony before Johnny could even change his mind. Then it was the custom for the honeymoon to last 1 whole year. However, with a 10-cow bride, you'd not take a 3-cow honeymoon. So 2 years later, the couple was welcomed back with great excitement. The groom was instantly recognized by a lookout, but the bride had changed dramatically. He didn't even recognize her at first. Instead of a shy and homely girl, she was now a beautiful and confident young lady. Her charm was so great. When she saw that someone had placed such value in her, a 10-cow bride she became. We need to give your mate someone or something to live up to, not down to. You will have a better mate when you speak into her or his life, when you build them up, when you show how much you love them and how much of worth they are to you. That will add to your marriage. Verse 10 says, your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, your neck with chains of gold. We will make you ornaments of gold with studs of silver. Solomon continues to pour that praise and adoration on her of her beauty. And in that day, a woman would wear that headdress that would have these ornaments hanging down. And so they were kind of up against her cheek. And so he's saying, your cheeks are lovely with these ornaments. And he sees chains of gold around her neck. And that caused the daughters of Jerusalem to want to bless her also. You know, when a man treats his wife well publicly, oftentimes it goes a long ways to how others begin to treat her as well. Verse 12 says, while the king is at his table, my spikenard sends forth its fragrance. A bundle of myrrh is my beloved to me that lies all night between my breasts. My beloved is to me a cluster of henna blooms in the vineyards of En-Gedi. So the Shulamite now is recounting how even if Solomon is at his table or he's attending to his kingly duties, his love is for her and it's with her. She's longing for the time when they will just be together. So she says Solomon was like that bundle of myrrh that lies all night between her breasts. And so what she's saying, she longed just to have Solomon there with her. Now, Hebrew women, of course, often wore these small bags of myrrh, these very spices and scents. They'd wear them around their necks. That would hang down and it'd be a sweet fragrance, which is very important in this day that predated deodorant, right? You don't have deodorant, you're out there busy working around, you can work up quite a stank. And so you wear this little, you know, bottle of myrrh or this bag of myrrh around and you're walking around and people are going, smells, that's great. What is that? Old Spice? What is that? I'm not sure, right? But not for a woman, I guess, right? But it's spice, it's myrrh, you know what I'm saying. So this is what they would see. And what she's saying is that Solomon's love, it's though it's just there with her, hanging around her neck. It's with her. She's just experiencing this love. And he was as attractive, she says, as henna at the refreshing En-Gedi oasis that sat there on the west coast of the Dead Sea. Henna plants were ones that bore this white blossom, and their leaves produced that reddish-orange cosmetic dye. Today, people get henna tattoos. It's that ink that goes on, kind of stains the skin, and it doesn't just wash off instantly. So she's as though saying this love of Solomon and this love for Solomon isn't just going to wash away. This is getting imprinted here. Just like the oasis of En-Gedi, Solomon was that person of refreshment for this Shulamite woman now. And then Solomon, what does he do? He returns this praise and adoration. In verse 15, Solomon now speaks back in response to his beloved, the Shulamite woman. And he says, behold, you are fair, my love. Behold, you are fair. You have dove's eyes. He's working on his, you know, lines here. It's a little bit something to leave you in want. You're kind of going, is that all you come up with there, Solomon? But what you see, there's just a great mutual love that's going back and forth, and it's building up this love. It's important that we communicate these things to our loved ones, especially to our spouse. Guys, are you reminding your wife how much you love her? Some guys, you say, listen, I told my wife when we got married I loved her. And if anything changes, I'll tell her, but I don't need to tell her again. Told her once is not good enough. Now you need to remind her. You need to pour on her that affection and let her know that you love her. And why? You need to do the same to husband. Tell, build them up. Let them know how much you love them, respect them, and how wonderful they are. And it's a mutual thing that we do. Here's what we see happening between the Shulamite woman and Solomon. They're just bouncing back and forth with this adoration, with this devotion, with this you know, work and words of love going back and forth to one another. And to say, here Solomon says that you have dove's eyes. speaks of, you know, just this longing gaze that he gives, you know, just looking into her eyes, and he's captivated with her. But interestingly, doves are a bird that stay with one mate. It's very different than what you'd see happening elsewhere in the animal kingdom, even within among different bird families. You see, the dove is one that mates for life. And this love, in the same way, was to be a single, devoted love. Verse 16 here, we read the Shulamite responding back. Now, behold, you are handsome, my beloved. Yes, pleasant. Also, our bed is green. The beams of our houses are cedar and our rafters of fir. So she's returning this loving praise, and she affirms his beauty. You're handsome, you know. And we, us men, we know we're confident oftentimes, but it's nice to hear sometimes too, you know. Whether we're balding or bulging, it doesn't matter. We need to hear that sometimes too, just as the ladies need to hear it. And so what does she do here? Now she recounts the outdoor setting where they first met. They met out in the kind of the vineyards, the pasture lands, you know, the mountain region in the Lower Galilee. And so they're recounting this outdoor setting. She remembers fondly time spent together, sitting in the green grass. That's why she says, our bed is green. Some believe it's actually translated, our couch is green. But what she's saying is like, man, we just planted ourselves out in the grass fields. And we sat down and we would just dote on one another and look into each other's eyes. And then they would look up, she says, we were just encapsulated by our house, which is just, you know, cedar trees and the fir as though they were the house beams or the roof, you know. We would just sit down and look up and the very nature around us was just like our home in a sense. And this is what she's saying. She's reflecting fondly, you know, back on the day when they were just courting and coming together. And then the Shulamite woman says in verse 1 of chapter 2, I'm the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys. Like a lily among thorns, so is my love among the daughters. The Shulamite here speaks of herself here, kind of in rather a self-deprecating way, all right? You see, as they would sit in the pasture lands, they would see countless lilies across the valley. The rose of Sharon was a common meadow flower as well. So what she's saying is she sees nothing special in herself. She's just like another lily among the valley. I'm the lily of the valley. There's nothing special about me. There's a plethora of them out there. And it's interesting that this description has often been attributed to Jesus, isn't it? We look at Jesus as the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valley. Though it is meant with good intentions, it is certainly misapplied. Because this is the Shulamite woman referring to herself here. And then in the second part of verse 2, Solomon responds to her comments with a reassuring love, because he says, you may be a lily, but you're a lily among thorns. In other words, you stand out. The other girls out there, they may be prickly, they don't interest me, but you clearly, you outshine them. You're not just a lily among the valley, you're a lily among thorns. You stand out. You're the thing that I gravitate to there on that flower. Like an apple tree among the trees of the woods, so is my beloved among the sons. I sat down in his shade with great delight, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. Here's the Shulamite woman speaking now of Solomon once more. It refers to him as an apple tree among the trees of the woods. Pays a compliment to him, because it would be very unusual to come up to any kind of a fruit tree while out in the woods. And to do so would be a welcome, refreshing sight. This is how she sees Solomon. Oh, man. I was kind of wandering out in the wasteland, but you came into my sights. And you were like that apple tree, that fruit tree that just brought refreshment to me. That's how she sees Solomon in comparison to all other men. So is my beloved among the sons. There's nobody like him is what she's saying here. Plus, she found shade with him, which often speaks of protection in the Bible. She felt great safety and security with him, not only physically, but just emotionally too. He's been reassuring her, hasn't he, of his love for her. Even though she's kind of been insecure about her look, she's sort of been self-deprecating. What has Solomon done? Just come right alongside and built her up. And here she's just responding, just so thankful and blessed because of that. She's feeling like $1 million with Solomon around. That 10-cal bride is how she's feeling. And now she's enjoying his fruit. It's just kind of sweet to the taste. Now, many see in this verse and the next few verses to follow the consummation now of marriage on that wedding night. What we see here then is a description of the sexual act, basically. Verse 4 says, he brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. Sustain me with cakes of raisins. Refresh me with apples, for I am lovesick. So passion is arising here. This is what we see. As we see this first section of Solomon, she's reflecting on the marriage day and no doubt leading up to this consummation of marriage. This love is very open and true. Notice here, it's like a banner over her. He doesn't say one thing in private and then contradict it in public. This love was widespread. It was known. He wasn't hiding it. He was letting all people know. And she feels it. She knows that his love, his banner over me was love. Just like being waved out there in the sky for everybody to see of his love for the Shulamite woman. This is an unashamed love. And this love is about to be satisfied through a physical act. There's been, the beginning of this foreplay that we saw in verse 3, beginning there and continues on here now. Now, both apples and raisin cakes were symbols of sexual passions. Hence, she calls for these to satisfy the passion. So in essence, having been aroused through foreplay, she now seeks satisfaction by the sexual act itself. This is the sense of her statement at the end of verse 5. I am lovesick. I'm lovesick, you know. She's ready for just the fullness of this now. And notice, we move into that here. Verse 6. His left hand is under my head and his right hand embraces me. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the does of the field, do not stir up nor awaken love until it pleases. Here's Solomon now. He's like a modern day romantic. He just kind of lays her down, his hand is behind her head, and the other hand embraces her. And what we see here now is just the two becoming one. All right? The consummation of marriage. This is the recounting of an evening of pure intimacy. The first of several that we'll see in this book. In fact, the language in these sections becomes so graphic and sensual that the Hebrew rabbis prohibited the Jewish young men from reading the Song of Solomon until they reached the age of 30. That's why it's taken me so long to get into the book. I've had to wait. Finally able to do it now. And so, listen, these passages, they're going to cause you to blush. They may steam your glasses, but they teach us that God created sexual expression, not just for procreation, but for pleasure. All right? And we see that happening right here in the book of Song of Solomon's. There was once a farmer who had 3 sows. He wanted to breed with his neighbor's boar. So he loaded his 3 pigs into the back of his pickup and drove to his friend's house. There he put him in the pen with the male pig, the boar, and left them the rest of the day. When he returned that afternoon, he asked his neighbor how he'd know if the mating was successful. Well, his friend said, in the morning, when you wake up, if the pigs are rolling in the grass, you'll know it took. But if they're rolling in the mud, you'll know it didn't. Well, the next morning, the farmer ran to the window to check on his sows, and there they were, all 3 girls out rolling in the mud. Ah, the farmer was disappointed, but he loaded up the pigs into his truck again to try again. The next morning, though, the 3 sows were once again rolling in the mud. Undaunted, the farmer loaded the pigs in the back of the pickup to try a 3rd time. That night, he had to fly out of town. The next morning, he called his wife and asked for a report. Are they in the grass or are they back in the mud? His wife answered, neither. 2 are in the back of your truck, and 1 is in the cab honking the horn. Obviously, his neighbor's pig was no boar. See, here's the point of this joke here. And it's a major, major point of the Song of Solomon. God created sexual expression, not just for breeding, but for it to be a blessing in the relationship. And it's a blessing when it's within the parameters of marriage. God intends sex to be fun and pleasurable. But that's just it. It is reserved for marriage. And it's the only place that it will be fun and pleasurable. This gives way to the instructions that the Shulamite woman gives to the daughters of Jerusalem. Now, what does she say at the end of verse 7? Do not stir up nor awaken love until it pleases. That's important right there. Don't start what you can't finish. That's a good word for singles today. Oftentimes, people lose their virginity outside of marriage without planning to do so. What happens? They get caught up in the moment, and one thing leads to the next. The problem is that they put themselves in a vulnerable situation. They put themselves in a place that they shouldn't be, that's not profitable or helpful. So the Shulamite wisely says, don't stir up these feelings or passions until you're able to fulfill them. She's experienced it. She knows it. She's consummated the marriage. She knows, oh man, I would not have been able to stop here unless we were married and within the confines of doing so. It would have been hard to stop. It would have been difficult and unpleasurable. So she says, don't stir these things up until it pleases or until you're able to fulfill them. And that means within the confines of marriage. Don't start what you can't finish. Listen, this whole section of Solomon, Song of Solomon, this section that we've looked at here so far, does indeed give us a great picture of the love of Christ for his bride, us, the church. And we've taken our time to go through this and look at what is happening in a historical and true encounter between two figures in history, Solomon and the Shulamite woman that becomes his bride. But the whole section sees Solomon leaving the palace and seeking out a bride from a lowly place. He finds a woman that, she says, dark, felt unlovable. And it's a great picture of our Savior Jesus, isn't it? Who left the palace of heaven. He came to us when we were dark, stained by sin, when we had nothing to love in ourselves. But Jesus came and he shared that love with us and he cleaned us up and he made us his bride. He gave value to us and he's shown an incredible love for us that while we were still sinners, he died for us. That's what we've been seeing in Romans chapter 5. And we can truly say, his banner over me is love. God is a God of love. And he's demonstrated the fullness of that love by giving us his son, Jesus, to die for us. When we were still sinners, when we were dark, stained by sin, just as the Shulamite felt. And I pray that you have felt and experienced now that incredible love of the Father and the love of a Savior that has done this work and brought us in as his bride. May you see today the great value that you have in his eyes, just as this woman has begun to see the value that she is in Solomon's eyes. Well, we'll pick it up in verse 8 of chapter 2 in a couple of weeks, all right? And we'll go on to see the reflection now on that courtship phase of their relationship. All right, let's pray. Heavenly Father, we come before you and we thank you for this book, A Song of Solomon. It's a book truly like no other, and it's a book that reveals to us that you are the God that's created all things and created these things to be good for us, even in the realm of sex that so oftentimes we feel uncomfortable talking about and discussing. And yet, God, you gave it. You gave it before the fall. And you said that all things were good. And so this is something that's not meant just to be a baby maker, but to be a blessing maker in the relationship within marriage. And so I pray that we would grow in these things, that we would learn through the book of Song of Solomon how to be a more loving spouse, a more loving person, and that we would see and be reminded all the more of the great love you have for us. So just continue this on now, Lord, in our lives, we pray. In your awesome name, Jesus. Amen.